Hi, Matteo, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ben, for having me.
No worries. Look, it would be good to understand more for the audience and everyone sort of listening a little bit more about yourself. So can you give a short intro about Matteo?
Sure, absolutely. We'll do it. I'm to be honest, my like nickname is Depo, because in Italy we are a lot of Matteo, so basically everyone is trying to find a nickname, so everyone is calling me Depo, even in UK or in Spain, when I'm speaking with the relevant stakeholders. So I'm Depo. I'm coming from Milan. I'm engineering manager in Prima, which is an insurance company, an insurtech, based in Italy, but now we have a business also in UK and in Spain. That's basically me. I am married. I have two kids. A lot of passion for football, cycling, and tech in this order.
DevOps processes. We'll definitely dive into that, in a little while. But it'll be good to understand, where and how you got to where you are today. So can you run through your tech journey, I guess, and how you sort of became the, engineering manager at Prima? Because obviously you've come from like a, very sort of strong sort of Linux background, haven't you? So just run through your sort of your tech background, I guess.
Absolutely, yes. First of all, even if I can see probably a little bit younger, I mean, and that's obviously absolutely not humble. Now I'm 40, so I'm coming from long years of how can I say, of troubles and of experience, in a sense. No, so basically my background is coming from the web application, generally speaking, from the software engineering world. No, so I started as a software engineer, and I started as a web developer in a small company here in Milan. I'm based in Milan, a small company that was super enjoyable, in a sense. So basically I transitioned in the DevOps engineer role, and then in more specialized roles in that field, basically along the years, starting from when you are working in a small company, especially in a small company like that one, you are basically somehow pushed and forced to experiment with everything, no? And given that I'm curious and my first passion is to solve problems, basically, I immediately tried to understand what was the next topic to address and to dig into, no? So that's basically the attitude that is underneath every DevOps engineer, no? So starting from the web developer mindset, dealing with Perl, Python, and JavaScript in those years, I shifted a little bit into the sysadmin mindset, so dealing with operating systems, and basically at that point, conjunction between the two worlds was basically pretty straightforward for building a DevOps engineer mindset. So understand how to automate things, and my background is that one. Having played with several things for several years, then I needed to specialize myself in the sense that after a bunch of years experimenting, basically just for the sake of context, I worked in that company for more than 10 years. And this basically is the symptom that I was super enjoying, like working for those people. And basically, our main the most important business was related to provide queue management systems. Those queue management in hospitals or in in the public sector, generically speaking. And those queue management systems were we needed to build the kiosk systems before having a kiosk operating system. So basically, we needed to automate everything on our own in order to let, because we were also providing hardware, not just the web application behind the system itself. So it was pivotal and super important to manage also those usual incidents that in the public sector are happening, power going off blackouts or whatever problem those hardware could have when dealing with people, no? So and with customers. So that specific experience somehow helped me in dealing with automation and in finding a smart solution for let the system go and work on their own. After a bunch of years, I saw the opportunity, and I also felt the opportunity of specializing myself in that field that was emerging. So basically, I understood that my skills, the skills that indirect way I was building were basically becoming a specific role. So basically I tried to understand better the theoretical part that was driving basically the DevOps methodology. So I studied tried to change company in order to I moved to Fastweb, that is one of the major telco company in Italy. There I specialized myself in dealing with probably most critical part for an infrastructure engineer, which is Kubernetes, and played with Helm and with all the technology stack related to the containerized applications and basically the orchestrators for containerized applications. But then I understood that probably a company such big, because we were talking at that point about a company about more or less 2,500 people, was a little bit too much for me, because I was used to work in a small company, we were 15, 20 people, something like that, no? And the jump was too high, no? Because you are basically changing a lot of habits in that sense, no? A lot of processes are completely different. So I decided to, after a small period back in my former company, in order to help them with a transition to a more concrete DevOps way of working, a few months, I joined Prima more or less 3 years and a half ago. And I started as a DevOps engineer, so basically doing classical DevOps infrastructure engineer job. Each company has its own flavor of the DevOps engineer role. No, it depends on the maturity of the company. It depends on a lot of aspects. Then basically I followed the changes, organizational changes that the company introduced, in the sense that Prima is a fast-paced environment. So basically changes are happening frequently in order to keep the pace with the business. So I still kept for, I was a DevOps engineer for 6-8 months, probably. Then I still kept a sort of infrastructure engineering role for more or less more than 1 year in a different department because of some organizational changes. And then after a year, like a sort of, I was more like transitioning to a site reliability engineering role in that year. So basically a little bit more focused on the, like reliability on the processes related to how to build reliable services more than practically building infrastructure. For like some other reasons still related to some organizational changes, given that I am a little bit not a super standard infrastructure engineer in a sense, not a super standard technical individual in a sense that I feel really important the DevOps methodology in my values, which means that I'm super keen to collaborate with people, super keen to help people in a sense. Saw in me the skills for like trying the management role, the engineering management role. So given that there was the space and the opportunity to try this challenge a couple of years ago and a half, I jumped into the engineering manager role for a site reliability engineering team. So all the skills and foundations that I had that I've built in the previous years in terms of technical stack are super useful because I can be opinionated, in the meetings when we are talking about delivery or we are talking about decisions to take, But at the same time, this DevOps mindset in a sense, which is super focused on collaboration and on people, is helpful for the engineering management part.
Yeah. How did you find the transition to leadership? Because I know you, from your side, like you said, that it's almost like part of the DevOps culture, right? I guess in the sense of the sort of cross collaboration and that side of things. But how did you find the transition into leadership over sort of the last couple of years? From being someone that is very much hands on. And now obviously you're very much focusing on, building, high performing teams, right? You're very much, like you said, sort of spreading your, the DevOps methodology across, Primer and making sure that processes are smooth, right? So from your end, how was the transition from being so hands on to, then going on to the leadership front?
Good question. The point is that, to be very honest, I decided to take that opportunity because I was feeling myself a little bit old, probably old in the sense that. Prima is an environment in which there are a lot of young individual contributors, in the sense that they are, we are talking about people about 20, 25 years old. And when you're close to turning 40, you are start feeling a little bit it's not a,
almost where should you be, I guess, like the in your career, right?
That's the point. No, where you should be, where are you feeling tired to keep constantly yourself in sync with new technologies, with new things. And I started feeling a little bit out of scope, in the sense that I felt the freshness of those younger colleagues, and I told myself, probably this T-shaped profile that I told myself, with this T-shaped profile that you have, a potential you could be more useful in another role. No, the challenge was to mostly to deal with external stakeholders, in the sense that the most challenging part wasn't the transition from the hands-on work to the people management, also because the engineering manager role, at least in the very early phases of my experience, of a super technical team like SRE's, is not bringing you out from the hands-on work at all. You can have, you can decide which kind of flavor of engineering manager you could be, depending on, first of all, the nature of the team, and also what you want to do, in the sense that if you have capacity, if you have bandwidth, you can play, if you have technical skills, with some, I don't know, issues and some cards around. It's also true that it depends on the nature of the team, which means that it depends on how much are your engineers skilled, in a sense. No, if you have super seniors, it does not make any sense probably to keep the hands-on work, and you can just focus on the delivery part, on the KPIs and that kind of stuff. If you have a team full of junior, probably you need also to be some kind of technical leader for them. No? So the experience, I had a super senior team, which is basically doubled, but I mean, is still super manageable from a people management standpoint. So I didn't feel so many pain in going out from the hands-on work, because it was a progressive process.
Do you miss any technical side of things? Do you miss being hands-on or not so much?
Sometimes yes. I need to be fair. Sometimes yes, and sometimes I am playing. I'm still playing with something. I'm really rusty, and I'm also introducing a lot of bugs in the absolutely not important things that I'm delivering in terms of coding. But sometimes yes, especially when things in the management, from the management standpoint, are getting more difficult. You are constantly, but this is an engineering manager behavior. Usually, it happens, especially when you were a technical person. Sometimes you are dealing with some, I don't know, friction between people, or complaints, or rants, or whatever, and you are like, oh,
I just want to write some code.
Yes.
It's really funny, because we speak to a lot of directors and managers and whatnot, and everyone has the same thing. If you're a true techie they always miss the technical part. You always do. I mean, it's a natural progression, I think, like what you said. I think once you get older, you start to think like you said, it's more of, you know, a young man's game, I guess, if you want to say, staying sort of relevant with the tech, I guess, because it's so constantly evolving. But everyone still loves being hands-on. Like, if you're a techie, you're a techie. Like, you just don't lose that thing, do you?
Absolutely, yes. And there's also, for example, I will make an example regarding my private like space. I'm also a coach of kids for a football team, no? And basically, I spent some nights during this summer in building a web application for managing, you know, those kids. And, you know, when the games, like calendars, scheduling, trainings, like schedule, and that kind of stuff. No, so I'm still somehow playing around. But the point is that at a certain point, especially when you are feeling yourself familiar enough, and also enough in a comfort zone with your company, this basically means that you are basically start thinking, if you have obviously those leadership skills, you are start thinking at the big picture, no?
Yeah.
And usually you are involved in those discussions, more strategic rather than tactical. So when you are approaching probably turning 40, I would say, or more or less in those years, you can start thinking about which kind of steps I should take. And usually the path are the two main paths. One is jumping the engineering manager role. So basically, if you have those empathy skills, you want to focus on people and let them deliver, probably the engineering manager role is the most suitable for you. Otherwise, if you want to be a little bit distant from the delivery processes, people management, etc., but you still want to have an impact from a leadership standpoint, the individual contributor role, like staff engineer or principal engineer, is probably your path in order to have a broader impact. So, generically speaking, yes, and I agree with you. Usually, we are missing those old glory days in which we were coding, which we were basically hands-on, because we were young, no? Somehow, so it's also like a sort of. Something related with life and with the old glory days in which we.
It's a good memory now, right? It's like behind you, right?
Yes.
The good competent engineer days are behind you.
Absolutely.
Good stuff. Look, let's dive a little bit away from tech for a moment before going back into it. But it'd be good to. Sort of, you know, for the listeners as well, to understand a little bit more about yourself and your thought processes behind sort of outside of work, I guess, as well. So, well, what keeps you busy outside of work?
First of all, my family, my kids. I have two kids. My daughter turned 10 yesterday. So, I mean, in the business since a while, and my son is approaching 7 in October, and basically what I mean, obviously apart from the family, my wife, the kids, my home, what is basically keep my mind busy out of business hours are the sports. I am super passionate about football, about cycling for myself, in the sense that I cannot play football anymore because of the knees.
Yeah. So old age again.
Getting older, no. So basically go cycling is my sport, is super important for me. I'm used to go cycling with a wonderful endurance or bear road bike during lunch break and in the weekend.
How much do you cover?
I mean, 50, 60, 60. Like a couple of the last couple of long trainings that I did were 100 kilometers around here around my life. Yeah.
Have you done any competitions for cycling or anything or any for charity events?
No, more than competitions, I'm participating sometimes to events. So the Randonnée, for example, in Italian are Gran Fondo. I don't know how to translate it, but those events in which providers, basically who is organizing the event, is basically taking responsibility for closing the streets and building the circuit. Super, super interesting and super enjoying, especially the ones that are organized in the countryside or in basically in mountain places.
Yeah.
Because usually when you are going in the mountains, there are a lot of cars and a lot of traffic, no? And if you have the street available only for cycling, is completely another experience.
Yeah. I mean, I watch sometimes, to be fair, I love cycling as well. I've got my own road bike and, I do a lot of cycling. For me, sport is the best way to get away from anything really. It keeps your head sane. For me, I play futsal, for instance, which is indoor football. Again, but still getting a little bit to that age where not sure how much longer you can go because the knees are a bit, start hurting and playing up. So the easiest way is to go to cycling and stuff like that because it is enjoyable and it's still really intense, isn't it? So from that as well then, so I mean, I was going to ask you, so how from throughout your career, I know you said sport is something that you go to. How do you, this could lead on to that, I guess, but how have you dealt with managing sort of work-life balance and well-being, I guess, and making sure that, I guess, you're not burning out from sort of your day-to-day work and, sort of not pushing yourself to that point where, you don't know what's going on, I guess, in the head. So how do you manage that and how do you go around that, I guess?
To be honest, for me, was dealing with sports and playing sports and is somehow a need exactly in that sense. The point is that I'm used to, in the past I also went through some therapy for that specific reason, in the sense that I was dealing with some stress and dealing with burnout basically because of working reasons. And because I wasn't super able to say stop to what I was doing, keeping myself busy with sports is basically therapeutic somehow, in the sense that it gives you that endorphin shot that somehow is relaxing you, is basically pulling out the power that you have when thinking about work activities and issues that you need to deal with. That's also why I am super keen to go cycling during lunch breaks, because even if from both distance standpoint and from timing standpoint is not super a training which is super super important to do, is super useful for me to keep myself sharp.
Mentally sane, isn't it? Between the sticks.
Between the sticks. Okay, that's the morning. Okay, let's sharp a little bit the mind, and let's keep the mind sharp, and let's take this endorphin shot, let's relax, and then let's go to the let's face the afternoon. So I mean, generically speaking, the sports are somehow a therapy for me more than anything else. And also kids are absolutely useful for like start thinking at something else compared to the world.
I thought you was gonna say they make it worse.
yes, exactly. No,
but to be fair, it's very common. I mean, we speak to a lot of people, and you know, a lot of people either have been either through therapy or had some sort of issues because there is that point of not knowing when to shut down. I mean, I had the same thing as well, and we've talked about this through a lot of our podcasts before. And like for me, obviously, I'm not working in IT per se. I'm still working with IT, but like for me, I used to have panic attacks, and that used to be because I used to push myself to the point where there's just too much going on, and my head's just like overthinking, and then it goes to a point where there's no coming back, and it's very difficult to find a way out of it. But for me, very similar to you, I think it was sport based that got me out of that rut, because it was a big rut, because it was too work focused. But I think sport is one of the best things you can do for sure, but just keeping I guess mentally sane. But from yourself, Matthew, I mean, how do you sort of portray that to your team, right? So to the guys that you manage, how do you help the team to make sure that they're managing burnout? How are you promoting that, I guess, with Primal?
This is my most the top priority for me, given that I went through something like that. And to be honest, we are also lucky in a sense that Prima is an environment in which the well-being and especially the timing of the working hours is guaranteed somehow. No, so you can have that flexibility of managing your own duties without too much pressure in terms of how many working hours you need to deliver for the company. So I'm like playing a role in an environment which is already somehow thinking in the same way I'm thinking. So it's definitely easier compared to maybe other managers that are playing the same role in other companies. And then for the specific delivery that we needed to provide, I'm constantly trying to protect my folks, in the sense that this is also coming from my background. So basically where I'm coming from, which was their role a couple of years ago, I'm constantly trying to not overcommit.
Manage
the workload in a safe manner is the key, in the sense that I am used to push back when I can see that we are approaching the peak, no, in a sense.
Yeah.
And another, given the nature of my team, which is an SRE team, so basically we are talking about supporting other product engineering teams, most of all. No, so we are talking about basically the structure is we have 17, 18 folks in the team, and our duty is basically to help other product engineering teams which have their own business delivery to provide for the rest of the company. Is also a matter of balancing what in the Google book is described at the like the SRE to engineers ratio. Because if this ratio is too much unbalanced, basically for them is a constant context switch every day, back channeling on Slack, direct messages that are being sent for them from various inputs, because maybe they are, I don't know, dealing with, I don't know, 50 people simultaneously, something like that. So having the real understanding of how many developers are member of the teams they should support is a metric that is super important in order to keep their, like,
keep them sane.
Yeah, basically balanced enough. I'm constantly updating the Google Sheet with this ratio, you know, for basically supporting those business domains, those business teams, with the new onboardings and new softwares that new joiners and new software engineers that are joining, in order to understand when I need to and where I need to open positions. And yeah, that's why the team doubled in the last last year, basically.
To help manage the workload, right? So yeah. People, yeah, that's good. I mean, it's really important. I mean, honestly, like, for someone in your position, like I said, like, that manages teams and is very sort of focused on, which we'll touch on in a little while, you know, building, you know, scaling teams with sort of, I wouldn't say minimal resources, but, you know, sort of scarce resources, if you want to say that. But it's really important, obviously, like you said, to just to focus on the well-being, I guess, because you've been there, you've done it, you know, you've had a long career, I guess, and you know, I guess, from your past where and what's gone wrong. So using your experiences to almost make sure that, you know, people don't experience, I guess, what you've experienced, or pushing them over the edge where, you know, people then start leaving and then there's even more pressure on people, which is, yeah, really important.
Yeah, yes, absolutely, yes. Exactly. It's exactly the point, in the sense that the very first part of the experience as an SRE, so basically, like, after the reorg that we had in Prima across the end of 2022 and the very first part of 2023, was following that reorg was following a model of a single SRE embedded per domain. And in Prima, a domain is a group of product engineering teams. In that experience that lasted like 6 to 8 months, more or less, something like that, I was an SRE for the claims domain. And even if all the software developers were super knowledgeable, were super keen to in understanding our bandwidth and our capacity, we were single point of failure. And this is something that for the well-being of the whoever is basically playing that role is something that we should avoid at all. No, that's why we built rebuilt the SRE centralized team, still delegate with people still delegated to various domains, but was basically at first hand was the intention was to, okay, let's focus on the well-being of those people, because they are feeling super lonely in dealing with the product engineering teams. They don't have a protected guild in which they can, talk together, deal together with an issue, etc. And also they are, they need to have someone that is somehow taking care of them from a people management standpoint. Yeah. That's why basically we built this structure and we extended this structure accordingly to that ratio, no, to that metric that is super important in order to keep them safe.
Nice. Yeah, good. So look, moving back more into the tech side, right? So more so on the DevOps front, right? So yeah, we've been speaking for a while and even before this, and you know, it's evident to see you're a very much you're a DevOps enthusiast, right? Like you like to promote, like you said, the methodologies and everything's DevOps focused, right? So from your side, I mean, how do you see sort of the current state of DevOps in the market right now, from your perspective?
Very, very good question. Let me say that from my I mean, I have like a narrow viewpoint in the sense that obviously working for a company since 3 years and a half in the way that I'm working for Prima is giving me like a partial like overview of what's going on. Obviously, I am in contact with and I'm following the community. My two cents are that we are in a moment in which we need to push for a more harsh, not harsh, let's say, I think that this is the time for the platform engineering, in a nutshell, in the sense that when the DevOps methodology started was obviously about collaboration, about breaking the, you know, the confusion wall between between developers and operations. But at this point, what I'm experiencing is that there is so much complexity around that, and again, we are coming back to the people and the well-being. For a single individual, manage all of this complexity is simply too much. So if you are us, I'm putting myself in the boots of a software developer, no? Okay, if we are talking about a software developer, a software engineer that is should deal with, I don't know, a single application or a small amount of applications that are more or less structured in the same way, maybe you can deal also with the infrastructure part and the operations part with some automation provided by the DevOps tooling. But if we are increasing the complexity, maybe if we are talking about like a complex environment like Prima's one, in which we are already talking about data products, we are talking about applications that are running on Kubernetes with some maybe specific flavors like Knative or like Istio or Service Mesh or whatever. Probably for a single individual, a single software developer is super complex to manage all of these layers of abstraction of complexity together. No? Starting from how to build a decent application from a software engineering standpoint, how to architect, how to keep it decoupled, microservices, et cetera, et cetera. So generally speaking, it seems to me that we need to push more for like a more consistent approach in order to keep their cognitive load low.
Yeah.
And provide those basically that tooling, those golden paths, those paved roads, call them like you want, but those basically set of tools that are simplifying their lives. And in that sense, I think that that the platform engineering is the direction to go for. We are not talking about super complex systems. I'm super I do agree with the view of Gregor Hope and of Manuel Pais and Matthew Skelton of Team Topologies that what is needed is a thinnest viable platform. So something that will provide value for the customers that are the developers. But we are in that situation in which DevOps should be considered a mindset, so somehow a philosophy, no?
Yeah.
While from a more practical standpoint, we need to manage all of this complexity in a way which is meaningful for developers, in order to let them be truly autonomous while they are building their applications. To let them be curious in a safe way if they want to learn something or if they want to like understand better what's going on under the hood. But at the same time, we cannot ask too much to them from an infrastructure viewpoint. We needed to give them some like easy way and easy wins for building infrastructure and be autonomous without too much effort from a knowledge standpoint.
Following on from that then, I mean, how have you, because obviously you've been at like Primo now for, like you said, 4 years or so, four and a half years. So from your end, I mean, you've been there from an engineer to like a manager point of view. How have you almost like personally decided what toolings need to be used within the team and, you know, not just used just for the hype, right? Like, because I feel like some toolings at the minute, I mean, it's more efficient for some companies than others. Like again, like for instance, like Kubernetes, right? A lot of smaller sort of organizations are tending to go down like say the ECS route because it's cheaper, right? And when you add the complexity, like you were saying before, of adding that Kubernetes front, it becomes too difficult for teams to almost manage. So from your point of view, how have you sort of adopted the toolings within Primer to make sure that, you know, it is efficient, I guess, and how have you sort of done that?
The answer is that it depends, in the sense that in the past, when it comes to, I mean, I needed to reject some proposal, not to reject, to like let some proposal die because of an unbalanced ratio between their complexity and the value that they basically were providing for the company or the customers. This happened several times in the past. It's always a matter of understanding the value that you are basically providing and the risk that you are basically going to introduce. Let me give you an example. I, even in when I wasn't an engineering manager, but I was still in some kind of tech leadership role, I pushed for maybe some technology stacks changes. And I always tried to go for the best compromise between the learning curve of people and the value that we were providing, and obviously the opportunity of like introducing a tool. And this basically happened for programming languages. This happened for tooling. Sometimes, for example, in the past, we did exactly the change that you were mentioning. So basically, when I joined Prima, we were executing our workloads with ECS because it was easier, it was cheaper, etc. Then we decided to migrate to Kubernetes because of some reasons related to how the company was scaling.
Yeah. You know?
But to be very honest, we are still like dealing with the learning curve that Kubernetes has on from a developer, from a software engineering perspective, from a developer perspective. Always is a matter of accepting a risk, no?
Yeah.
In that specific situation, we accepted the risk of having troubles from a learning curve standpoint on the software engineering side, because we really needed a tool like Kubernetes for the scaling purposes that the Prima business growth was having. Maybe sometimes we decided to not go for adopting a tool because of the opposite, because the learning curve was too much. You need to evaluate risk to understand which kind of mitigations you need to put in place. For example, for Kubernetes, mitigations are provide courses, provide learning opportunities, but also simultaneously building those paved roads, those golden paths from a platform engineering standpoint, and understand if the risk is acceptable or not.
Nice. So that was literally going to be my question for you, because obviously you've worked for smaller companies before, right? So it is going to be more so for organizations that are trying to simplify their stack. Like, where should they start, right? And it's almost like what you just said. It's almost like understanding the risk, understanding almost like is there value to it, and understanding like where do you want to be as a company, I guess, right? Because I think it's like what you said. I guess it also depends on the scale and the growth of a company as well. So from you guys to move from, you know, ECS to EKS Kubernetes side of things is that growth size, right? It's scaling it out, and it does make sense. But for smaller companies, I guess it's not viable. And again, it's very costly, like you said.
No, I totally agree, in the sense that in the past, when I was in a smaller company, I evaluated Kube as a potential next step for the containerized applications. But then, I mean, you are introducing so much complexity, and then in that specific case was also not EKS based Kubernetes, so even more complexity, because we were talking about the bare bones. Yeah, bare bone solution. So super, super complex. But generically speaking, you always need, I mean, we are as technical individuals, are always used to go for the next fancy programming language or next wonderful tool, no? When you are a manager, you need to have that big picture, no? And you need to understand where it does make sense to introduce more complexity, or to push people for changing their habits and introduce a change, which is always a complex thing for individuals. No, so it's a challenge. You are taking them out of their comfort zone. So there should be really good reasons for doing such a change. Obviously, this doesn't mean that we cannot, we shouldn't change frequently, or we shouldn't change at all, or we need to keep our decisions super super balanced because people don't want to change. Is again a matter of being super analytic and understand risks and accept those risks when introducing important changes.
Nice. So from almost going to a different point in the sense of the DevOps front as well now. So I know you said sort of right now you see it as the next step is that platform engineering front, right? Where do you see DevOps in, say, 5-10 years? But where do you see the future of DevOps, and what's going to sort of, I guess, impact it or make it better or worse in your eyes? Where do you see it going?
To be honest, I think that when it comes to the the platform engineering wave will have a success, we will be able to let developers be very autonomous, truly autonomous in what they are delivering. And potentially what I can see now is that sometimes we are asking too much to them, which means that sometimes we are letting them go a little bit far from this curiosity they have in dealing with infrastructure, no? So to be very honest, for managing this complexity, we need to again deal with operations, with infrastructure, with automation in a more easy, definitely in an easier way. I think that managing the complexity through platform engineering, to be honest, is something that will somehow change the future of the DevOps methodology entirely, in the sense that I can feel sometimes already developers saying, this is too much for me. I cannot deal with that. So people that maybe were interested in understanding DevOps concepts, how to automate through CI/CD, how to the deployments through CI/CD, how to maybe even start thinking about a potential GitOps approach, maybe thinking about how to deal with infrastructure as code, that are saying, no, this is, I mean, too many layers. I cannot deal with all of that. No. So if we will be able to manage this enormous amount of complexity with some abstractions, the collaboration between infrastructure engineers and software engineers will be super efficient and will be successful. Otherwise, I fear that will be difficult to keep this wall of confusion broken, to be honest. Is something that it drives me crazy, in the sense that with such amount of complexity, the challenge is to make this complexity easier. Otherwise, the wall of confusion, so basically the split between dev and ops, will come back.
Yeah.
This is the feeling that I have.
Yeah. So look, leading on from that as well, then, I mean, for that complexity and I guess, you know, what's out there to ease that complexity. I mean, what's your thoughts on AI and, how that's making things, I guess, easier for you guys as engineers? What's out there and what are your thoughts for you to ease the workload and make things sort of less complex?
Possibility that AI is giving are to me enormous, in the sense that I am, for example, used, given that I don't have capacity, always have low bandwidth, etc. I'm used in Primo, we are used to, in the tech stack for infrastructure as code, we are using Pulumi, which is an awesome infrastructure as code tool. I'm used to ask to Pulumi AI to build for me some code, which is something that, to be honest, I strongly suggest, in the sense that is basically helping, especially when you are learning, so basically in the middle of the learning curve, in order to experiment and in order to understand which kind, especially for coding infrastructure, is something that can help a lot. Obviously, then simultaneously, you cannot trust, from my personal standpoint, completely what is being provided by the AI, in the sense that you need to delve, you need to dig the code for the infrastructure that the AI provided for you in the context and the environment that you are basically dealing with. So maybe you need to provide some changes because of that specific compliance reason that your company is asking for, no? But for sure, it's going to speed up a lot the coding itself, and also lowering the learning curve. The ramp is definitely going to be lower, because you have coding examples for the specific need that you needed to fulfill. At the same time, is providing you something to increase your capacity that can help in providing you some space and some bandwidth for learning, studying, and helping and
developing.
Making you more knowledgeable about the concepts that are behind.
From yourself, Matteo, what's the sort of, I guess, success rate that you've seen that you use, like, say, Pulumi AI, right? So what's the, for the coding front, like, how accurate have you seen it been from an AI perspective? Because a lot of the time, everyone says the same thing, right? It could definitely help you if you understand, like, you know, what's happening. From a junior point of view, I don't think it's very good, because if anything, like, I guess we can touch upon for that a bit in a second, but it's more so like, how accurate have you seen it been from, you know, the AI coding point of view?
Very good question. Let me say, good enough is the short answer. But now you are challenging me, and you are right in the sense that I am speaking about, for example, Pulumi AI from even if Rusty a necessary standpoint, which means that I know what I need if I need, for example, to build an S3 bucket with some replication rules. No, from a junior perspective, potentially you don't know which set of rules or set of resources you need to build around the resource that you need to build first, for example, an S3 bucket, because when you are talking about infrastructure as code, especially with some tools, for example, AWS, I mean, from a coding perspective, you need to decouple in several lines of code the API calls that your tool is basically providing to AWS, which is definitely more complex compared to what you are doing in a click-opsy way on the console UI. No, so for a junior, potentially for a junior software engineer, the AI is helping a lot, because that specific tool is at least, I'm quite sure that is helping in at least listing all the resources that for sure that junior engineer will have forget while coding on their own, basically.
But the fundamentals, right?
Yeah, I mean, considering that, for example, if you need to build an S3 bucket, you need then to add potentially some other resources, when you are coding with infrastructure, in order to, for example, keep that S3 bucket safe. You need to enable versioning. You need to enable potential replication rule. You need to code a lot of things that maybe are not immediately visible from a junior viewpoint. You are just building an S3 bucket, calling the S3 method calling the method from the Pulumi provider in order to build the S3 bucket without surrounding that resource with the needed other resources from a reliability and security standpoint. Pulumi AI can help in that sense. So it can help you in at least highlighting the bare minimum resources that you need to surround your most important resources with. So can help in that sense.
Yeah.
There is also that matter of understanding what you are doing.
Yeah.
You remember that meme that senior engineer that is basically reviewing the pull request look goes to me, and the bubble is, I don't know what I'm doing, something like that. So there is also that matter of knowing potentially what you are doing, and dealing with AI, it's absolutely helpful. But we need you need to reinforce, especially if you are a junior, that activity with the fundamentals that you need to like set up with the proper courses and with learning.
Yeah, so I was going to say, like, I mean, I feel like it's a good tool where you could use for assisting you, but you should never rely on it, right? And it doesn't matter what you use it for, because at the end of the day, like, there's going to be mistakes. But from a senior point of view, I think it could be really good for, you know, giving you the base of, say, I don't know, a code. So a lot of other people are saying it's, I don't know, it all depends, but it could, there's obviously mistakes, right, from what it's going to tell you in a code perspective. But from a senior point of view, it's good because it gives you the sort of the, here's what it is, and then you can just sort of change it up, and it does save you a lot of time. From a junior point of view, I feel like nowadays there might be more engineers that could be relying on it more, which makes it difficult to understand, like you said, if they actually understand what's going on, right? So from your point of view, I mean, have you, because obviously you hire and you're the engineering manager, right? So have you experienced recently or anything, like when you're hiring, have you experienced where it seems maybe like there's some AI going on or anything on that point of view?
To be honest, not personally, but yes, I also, because when I first of all, is difficult in the sense that I'm as an engineering manager, I'm doing only the management step, which is the last one, no? And the technical steps are coming before in the pipeline. But yes, we have experience of people that, for example, we are used to ask for a technical challenge, even for the infrastructure engineering teams. And then after the technical challenge, we are used to, if the technical challenge is good enough, we are used to schedule a technical step, a technical interview with a couple of SREs of the team in order to understand what about the technical things about the technical challenge, so potential improvements, issues, whatever. And then from there, start a discussion about in order to assess the skills. And yes, the point is we experienced several cases in which the technical challenge was good or super good or excellent. We somehow spotted the risk of a technical challenge completely done via ChatGPT or via AI, generically speaking. And then in the technical interview, the candidate absolutely not at least not knowledgeable accordingly with the technical challenge, which is something that is happening. It's also true that sometimes when we have the idea, the suspect that the technical challenge was at least integrated with some AI activities, we are absolutely not against it, no? In the sense that it's fine, no? It's a tool. Let's understand then in the technical interview if that was used exactly like a tool or like the provider of the solution itself, and there's no knowledge underneath, no?
It's not using too much of it, right? That's what I mean. You can't just throw your whole technical assessment in AI and then submit it. because we've experienced that before recently. That's the whole point. Like, so I feel like it's becoming more common, where I feel like the more experienced engineers, I would like to say, they probably wouldn't do that, but the people that are just coming through are, you know, just throwing the whole thing into AI and they're submitting it. And there is ways to find out, like, that they've used AI. There's software now that can detect it. There's certain dashes as well that you know it's AI, right? So it's one of them. It's almost like it gives them they think it's like an easy way to do a technical task, but if anything, it just puts them in a worse position, doesn't it? In that perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. That's. But I mean, again, I'm using AI every day, even for managing the changes that I want to do on my road bike. So I'm totally not against.
No, it's good. It's a good tool.
It's usage. No, the as you as always, and to be honest, I think that will be and is already a revolution like internet in the 90s.
Yeah.
Something that is like really game changing for the entire world.
Yeah.
The point is, how are you use the tool?
Yeah.
Making an example related to internet and related to how people are using internet. If you have, sore throat, and you are going to Googling about your sore throat, you are probably going to die the day after, okay? Accordingly to what you are reading on internet, right?
Yeah.
So again, probably in that situation, it's better to have an health check with your doctor, no? That's the more or less the same parallel. Let's use the tool.
You say that as well, Matthew, but I use AI, but I don't use it as much for work. For me, I use more so like personal side of things. I like to, if I do use it. So for instance, like I did two ligaments in my ankle. It was about 2 months ago now, right? And to be fair, I've done this, like every time I get an injury, what I do is I take a picture of the injury and I ask chat, I say, what's wrong with me, right? And it's so funny, but like it's so accurate. So I went to the doctor and I did this before I went to see the doctor. And basically I did a grade 2 tear on one ligament and I stretched the other ligament. And ChatGPT got the exact two ligaments right from the picture. And it tells you straight away, it says, I'm not a doctor, but I think it's this, right? And it's crazy how accurate. Like for me, it's like I took a picture, I pointed with my finger where the pain is or where it's hurting. And it tells you like, it's this. And it's super accurate. It's crazy. Like for me, that
absolutely. Absolutely. That's the same for me. And coming back to the road bike, I tried a tool, AI driven, for doing the bike fitting, just recording a video of myself on the home trainer, in order to understand which kind of changes I needed to do on my bike in terms of seat or the front wheels or whatever, and was super accurate. So generally speaking, it's a revolutionary tool.
Yeah.
But we still need to keep in mind that is a tool. So at least for the time being, we are still in the driving seat.
Yeah. No, because that's what I mean. When I used it, I still went to the doctor again just to make sure. But it's almost like there's the options, and I wanted to see so what actually happened, and it's crazy how accurate it is. And
totally.
But again, it's not always accurate, but again, there is a high. It's very useful in certain situations, isn't it? But look, let's dive in more to, I guess, the work that you do in that primer and that side of things as well. So, from yourself, we've discussed quite extensively about, you know, like the DevOps front and, you know, just engineering in general. What are some of the challenges that you faced, you know, whilst you've been at Primer that you faced, I guess, and like, how have you overcome them from an engineering or management point of view?
Some challenges are still ongoing. No, jokes apart, one of the most important challenges that I faced with was how to let people understand the mission of the team of a series that we were building. Because when basically we decided to, a couple of years ago, to come back to the centralized reporting line for those series, some people, I could have been in their boots. I could have been in the same their situation. So I agree with them in a sense, in terms of fears and in terms of how they were scared. They were scared about a lower responsiveness in terms of delivery, in terms of how much time we were dedicating to them for their business related initiatives, etc. So it was challenging, a very first activity as an engineering manager, to influence people without power, because we were talking about people at the same level, at the same role, so basically zero power in terms of hierarchy, no? Even if I'm not a manager that is using hierarchy for making decisions, I'm trying usually to make the best decision accordingly also with the team mindset. But generically speaking, especially when you don't have that hierarchy that can sustain from a maybe indirect viewpoint your opinion, you need to influence, you need to do politics, even if could be intended as a bad word, no, in this moment. But generally speaking, you need to convince people, you need to buy them, and you need to let them know which are your intentions and which is the value that you are basically going to provide for them. And the very first challenge that I faced was that one. So let people understand without a top-down approach, that our team will have provided value for them. So this is the very first thing that is coming in my mind.
Okay.
Usually, what I learned in the process is that data is super useful for convince people. So if you are able to measure which kind of situation are you dealing with some metrics, and potentially let people understand with a projection or with some other data that a specific change will provide value for them, you have a sword in your hands, in the sense that data are super useful. Another challenge, for example, when I changed the reporting line a couple of 1 year and a half ago, so the head of infrastructure changed, and my new boss wasn't super keen, and it was for potentially good reasons, to hire more SREs for the team. While I was observing my SREs already at the top of whatever human peak sustainable, coming back to the well-being discussion that we did before, no, of a human being, for a human being. Because he was more convinced in a strategy that was like aiming to shift more responsibility to developers. And I wasn't super convinced about that because we weren't able to do so because of the capacity of SREs. If you want to shift more to developers, you need to pair more with them. You need to teach them. You need to coach them, to be a mentor for them. If you have people already at a peak, they don't have a capacity for slowing down their processes in order to teach people. So in that specific, for that specific challenge, I like sustained my reasons with data and with that SRE to engineers ratio coming from the Google book that was clearly showing that we were basically working with an unsustainable ratio. And starting from that point, I am constantly taking care of this ratio in order to keep the workload sustainable for the people, in order also to let them try to do that pairing sessions and try to involve developers in their daily work in order to upskill them and shift to them more.
Yeah. Okay, nice. I mean, from your start then, I mean, Primer, then this one's an interesting one because it's obviously very, I guess it's your idea of it, but it's, how do you measure success at Primer from a technical and sort of cultural health point of view? Like how, as a engineering manager, what does success look like for you as a team for Primer?
Let me answer first from a philosophical standpoint, in the sense that, I mean, for me, success is having a team that is full of people that is happy and satisfied while they are doing their job. This is something unmeasurable, or better. No, I mean, you can measure it because I'm constantly measuring it with surveys and with feedback, giving and receiving feedback constantly one-to-ones with structured surveys, etc. But generally speaking, surveys are always somehow biased about personal reasons or whatever. The success for my team is given that we are making a lot of effort and putting a lot of hours in what we are doing on a daily basis in the workplace. That's the definition of success for me as an engineering manager. Then we have the success that we need to monitor and we need to measure
the metrics. When
it comes to talk about delivery or talk about well-being or talk about goals that we need to have, no, that we need to reach. And this is always related to KPIs. So which are for each specific initiative that we are basically dealing with, the key performance indicator that we need to track, and does success mean for that specific KPI? Let me give you an example. We are struggling with the amount of requests that we are getting for adding, rolling, and rotating secrets. Let's build an initiative for introducing an automated way for developers to do the same thing without bothering SREs, which is the KPI that we are measuring. 10 requests per month on an entire amount of 70 are related to secrets management. That's the KPI. So that's the performance indicator that we have. How do we want to measure success in that sense? Do we want to lower them to, 50%, 70%? Do we want to lower them to zero? that's basically the way we are measuring success. So defining performance indicators and understanding which goal we want to reach. And if the key result is like met, we can think about a success for a specific initiative.
Nice.
But from a more engineering management standpoint, so a people management standpoint, talking about the people management side of the role compared to the delivery one, the well-being of the team is the key, in the sense that you can deliver if you have people that are satisfied and happy or about what they are doing. No, otherwise, yeah. Also the pace, the quality are lowering down. Those are metrics that are probably more difficult to monitor. Maybe not the pace, but for sure the quality is more difficult. You can monitor it with the DORA metrics, basically, but. The first goal, to me, the first goal of an engineering manager should be to let, and the first goal of a coach, generically speaking, if you can think to a football coach, for example, is to put the right footballer in the right position in order to
succeed.
Help the team in the right way, no? And that's basically the same. So.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. And last couple of questions and then we're done. But I mean, from your sort of successful career that you've had, I mean, for someone that is either sort of starting their journey, so, you know, started becoming an engineer, what advice would you give to any engineers that are stepping into sort of this space? And it's either that or the leadership front. Like, what advice would you give for people that are coming into as an engineer and also moving into like a leadership front?
For an engineer, in general, is to let the passion burn, let the fire burn. So be curious. Maybe not only for engineers, generally speaking, in the life. No, be curious, and being curious means that you can. After a bunch of years, you can play on several pitches, no? You can do, you are somehow contaminated with such amount of things that can let you maybe even consider a change in your career if you are maybe more interested into something else. So it can be if you are curious enough, generally speaking, your attitude is to be smart enough to face any challenge you can have in your career, more or less. Because the attitude is to try, study, see what is under the hood, and make it manageable. From an engineering, for both, I would say, but especially for someone that is like trying to play a leadership role. First of all, things happens because of people. Not because of processes or because of top-down decisions or because of technologies. People are making things happen, basically. So one thing that sometimes from an engineering, from like software engineers, we are not super used to do is to talk each other. And if you are in a leadership role, especially when you have these like a sensitivity that frictions are arising, a good old school talk between people and let people communicate with through team buildings, especially if the team or the folks are working remotely, is absolutely a key factor for building successful teams. So in that sense, having an honest and transparent communication together with the people, without too many overstructures or foggy like sentences, that kind of stuff. Transparent, direct, clean. And let people meet together, let people talk together, let people communicate together is probably the most important thing in a team. So, yeah.
Nice. Good stuff. Awesome. Look, last question from my end before we wrap it up. But like I said to you, when we finish off the podcast, we have a previous guest that will ask you a question, and then you can ask a question for the next guest. So the question actually came from Dave Verrett, and his actual question was to yourself. So it was, what's the one place in the world you'd like to visit, and why? That's Dave's question to you.
Thanks, Dave, for the question, because I'm an addicted of traveling, so it's a very difficult one. Probably now is Argentina, Buenos Aires, or I cannot decide, or Tokyo. Well, I don't know.
Why?
Because first of all, I'm a football addicted, so I'm really keen to go around,
see the culture and.
Yeah, the culture about the football team there, and also I spoke with a couple of friends that went there, and from a natural standpoint, it seems to be honest awesome. So also that would be interesting. For Tokyo, to be honest, is more like my wife desire, but is also super interesting because again is another change of culture that I would understand physically somehow. No, so those two.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. One of my friends is in Argentina now, and he does more futsal stuff, but it's football futsal. And honestly, so some of the things that it sent across is crazy. Everything and everywhere, everyone's either playing football or futsal on the concrete courts. You can really feel the passion that's there just for the game when you just walk around the streets, everyone's either got a ball or everyone's just playing, or there's just football tops and football games. It's amazing. Honestly, it is. And what's your question for the next guest?
I will shoot this one, which is, I'm used to do this question when I'm interviewing people. But so basically focused on the job, but I will rephrase it in something more generic, what do you love the most and what do you hate the most about people? That would be a challenging one, I guess.
That is a hard one. Good stuff. Awesome. Look, Matteo, thank you for your time. Really enjoyed speaking with you. And finally, for all the guests and anyone, how can they, stay in touch with yourself? What's your best way to sort of stay in touch with you?
The definitely the best way is to add me on LinkedIn, and feel free to ping me on LinkedIn. I will maybe share with you the contact, which is super straightforward. So let's keep in touch there.
Awesome. Good stuff. Matteo, thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ben.